This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Wu Man's Gateless Gate, Case 9, Daitsu Chisho. The main case. Once a student said to Master Seijo Koyo, "Daitsu Chisho Buddha did zazen on a bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. Buddha Dharma was not manifested, nor did they attain Buddhahood. Why was this?" Seijo said, "Your question is splendid indeed." The student persisted, "They did zazen on a bodhi seat. Why did they not attain Buddhahood?" Seijo said, "Because they did not attain Buddhahood." The commentary. The old foreigner may know it, but they cannot really grasp it. An ordinary person, if they know it, is a sage. A sage, if they can grasp it, is an ordinary person. Woman's poem. Rather than give the body relief, give relief to the mind. When the mind is at peace, the body is not distressed. If mind and body are both set free, why must the holy saint become a lord? So we're concluding an introductory retreat this morning. And so throughout the weekend, we've been talking a lot about zazen and the ways that is integrated into various forms of training and life. And the koan in the Zen tradition is a form of zazen. So beginning in the Buddha's own experience of having been taught various forms of meditation and then developing that, experimenting with that, and then teaching that throughout his many, many years of teaching, and then the continuation of that over these many centuries, meditation being such a central practice and element in some, not all of the schools of Buddhism, but certainly our tradition. And because, in essence, all dharmas are dharmas, all phenomena embody Buddha nature, have the nature of emptiness merged with their appearance and form, because nothing is fixed, because consciousness, mind, is vast and boundless. In a sense, we can turn towards anything and study that and see the totality. But Buddhist practice is also based on skillfulness, upaya. And so what forms of meditation, what ways of working with your mind and your body, and everything that that includes, which is pretty much everything, are most effective? Are most effective for people in general as sort of universal practices, but then also within that have the capacity to be flexible and adapt to the individual. Because upaya ultimately comes down to whether it is helpful to you as an individual, as a practitioner. And so the various forms of meditation that are developed over the centuries are, in a sense, the fruit of that exploration. And so there are forms of meditation that are focused on an object, like the breath, or a visual object, or a question, as in the case of a koan. There are forms of meditation that are objectless. And then there are various ways of working with those objects. And so it's important to appreciate that zazen or meditation in Buddhism is not two-dimensional. It needs to evolve to meet the needs of the person and also evolve as that person, you, the practitioner, evolve. The koans developed in the development of Buddhism in China and the in a sense, dawning of the Zen tradition and take many different forms. They're essentially a public case, a koan, a question, a situation, a piece of teaching, as in this case, this is drawn from a sutra, the Lotus Sutra. Sometimes it directs the attention of the student to an object. And as with all forms of meditation, the point is always the same, is to see into self-nature, to see into the nature of self and other, of self and all phenomena. And so one reason there are so many koans in our training is because there are so many aspects of phenomena to examine. And the koan is important because it's, and very powerful, because in a way it's a marriage between our conceptual mind and our non-conceptual mind, between being able to understand something and then to be able to use that to go beyond that understanding into the heart of being. In essence, all forms of practice are like that. All forms of practice are designed to be liberating. The koan does it very directly, and in a sense, dangerously, because it is employing the very stuff that we get so tangled in, words and phrases, the meaning of things. But that's also what makes it so powerful, because the only way we can see into the truth that the koan is presenting us with is if we break free of those entrapments that are so deeply conditioned within us. And if we, as we do it within the koan, we become more and more able to do it in all of the words and phrases and meaning that we're immersed in our ordinary life. So in this koan, there's a passage from the Lotus Sutra in which the Buddha is explaining to his disciples, and he says, the lifetime of Daitsu Chisho, which means the Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom, the lifetime of this Buddha was 540 trillion myriads of eons. Now, an eon is an unimaginably long period of time, and there are different ways of describing an eon. So if you take an iron mountain, a mountain made of iron, there's 1,000 miles high and 1,000 miles wide in every direction. And an angel comes by every 1,000 years and brushes her silken wing across the face of the mountain. An eon is how long it will take to wear that down to level ground. So it's a while. So here this Buddha sat on the Bodhi seat for 540 trillion eons. At the beginning, when that Buddha, sitting on that place, had liberated all the myriad forms of Mara. So this Buddha has already broken free of all of the self-entanglement of history and karmic obstructions and emotional entanglements and self-doubt and all of the stuff that we get so tangled in. And then the Buddha says, and though they were at the point of attaining supreme awakening, the Dharma of enlightenment did not appear to this Buddha. So for one small eon and then for 10 more small eons, they sat cross-legged with body and mind uncreated. In other words, not producing anything, not creating karma, not creating obstructions, not creating body and mind. But the Dharma of the Buddha still did not appear to them. And so Seijo, this master, takes this up and has obviously taught this, or this student has studied this in the Lotus Sutra, and is concerned. The Buddha himself sat throughout his whole life, before his enlightenment, in the very moment of his enlightenment, and for the rest of his life, he sat meditation every day. It's said that because he was teaching so many people as his community grew, that he would still sometimes wander off into the forest to be alone. And that he was traveling and teaching much during the day, but the nighttime was when he would do his intensive practice his whole life. And that he taught that to all of his disciples and to us. And so here we are today in this Buddha hall, in this hall of awakening. Brand new students, some who have been practicing for many, many years, practicing this ancient path, this immediately present and contemporary path. And throughout all of history, people, of course, have examined everything that we experience in the world, our world, the forces in it, our solar system, plants and animals, the earth, rivers, this human form, wanting to understand what is it, how does it work, how do we use it, how do we get what we want from it. But all along, as Evelyn Underhill, who wrote a book on mysticism, said, a curious and definite type of person, a type of person who refuses to be satisfied with that which other people call experience, life, the world, and is so inclined, in the words of this, of their enemies, to deny the world in order that they may find reality. Throughout the history of people, there have been such curious people. A curious and definite type of inclination. She says, we meet these people in the East, in the West, in ancient, medieval, and modern worlds, and their one passion, their one hunger, their one thirst appears to be the prosecution of a certain spiritual and intangible, unmeasurable quest, the finding of a way out or a way back to some desirable state in which alone they can satisfy the longing, their longing for ultimate truth. So it was with the Buddha. So perhaps it may be for you. Some of us may still be discerning, what is this? What is my longing? But that recognition, that inner sense, to me is part of our miracle, part of our mystery, that immersed in a world, a physical world, in which our senses are explicitly designed to see and recognize and measure and know, and that we can experience immediate forms of pleasure and immediate forms of pain, and have become so adept at creating a multitude of ways to create pleasure and pain, that all along, if we listen carefully, there's an inner sense that, and a dawning sense for practitioners in the raising of bodhicitta, is that we get to a point where we realize there's no amount of tangible knowledge or information or external circumstances or pleasure or avoidance of pain that is going to bring us to an inner sense of satisfaction. And for some of us, that's where we begin seeking. We recognize that there are many things that bring us pleasure and satisfaction. The Buddha taught this. But we also realize how fleeting and fickle they are. We can't rely upon them. And even at peak moments where everything seems to be coming together, if we listen carefully, I think we'll recognize that something has been left unfulfilled. You know, over the years, I've heard over and over and over again some variation of this. A person who reports that while they still have challenges in their life, that they realize that in many ways they have a blessed life, they have many good things, they have friendships, family, they have relatively good health, they have work, that they're not living a life of desperation, or that they have a fortunate life. And yet still something is not satisfied. And that every time they set out to accomplish some new goal, to set out on some new path, to achieve something that is meaningful to them, that they find that at the moment that they accomplish it, there's a kind of quiet voice inside of them that says, so now what? Master Dogen said in Fukai Zazengi, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for any special effort? Indeed, the whole body and mind and being is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean, to sweep the dust away? It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to practice? And yet, if there is a hair's breadth deviation, it is like the gap between heaven and earth. If there is the least like or dislike that arises, the mind becomes lost in confusion. In a sense, the whole of our life turns in that and yet. We could say that the whole of Buddha Dharma abides within the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. To the extent that we understand that directly and are able to live in accord with that, we are free. It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around? Yet, there is that hair's breadth deviation, that sense of distance and gap. And it's that gap in which practice occurs. That's where we bring our attention. And so this Buddha, Daitsu Chisho, sitting on this diamond seat, the very same seat you're sitting on, for 540 trillion myriads of eons. Buddha Dharma was not manifested, nor did they attain Buddhahood. Why? How can this be? This is a clear path of practice and verification from the time of the Buddha. The Buddha made it very clear. I mean, if you know anything about the Buddha, you know this guy's not messing around. Right? He has no desire whatsoever to waste a precious moment of this precious life, his nor ours. And he only taught that which he felt was explicitly and expressly essential to that very path. And so there were questions that he wouldn't answer. There were conversations he would not engage in. Sometimes because to engage it meant he had to stand and in a certain sense affirm the basic delusion that the assumption of the question was based in. And so he was all about practice and verification. He wanted to be free. He wanted us to be free. And so this student's question is quite honest. Why? A sincere student would want to know. Every night we are reminded of this. Life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by. An opportunity is lost. We should not squander our lives. Buddha Dharma was not manifested, nor did they attain Buddhahood. Why? And Seijo said, your question is splendid. Now the teacher, remember, the teacher really has one purpose in life, which is to help the student to realize himself. That's why we're here. When we talk about the relationship between student and teacher, because relationship is such a big word and means so many different things. And within any relationship, there are many relationships, we might say, as is true of the student-teacher relationship. But one of the things that's important to be clear is that the fundamental purpose of that is this, is liberation. And so here, Seijo, is this teacher, is being asked this very sincere question. Now, one might conjecture that it's an intellectual question. The student is just, I don't hear it that way. in the koan, the student is a monastic. They've devoted their life to the way. They want to know what the hell's going on that this Buddha sat and did not attain Buddhahood. Seijo says, your question is splendid indeed. How is that responding? Why didn't he answer him directly? Why didn't he explain? Why didn't he give advice? Or did Seijo respond directly? So part of the aliveness of the koan is we have to enter into it. If we sit back and hear it from just our ordinary perspective, then we'll come to ordinary understandings, which may be entertaining or not, but they're not going to really help us. And so to take Seijo's answer seriously, your question is splendid. What is he saying? If you are the student and you are asking that question because it matters, you want to know. In practice, we say, practice as though your head is on fire. Right? When your head is on fire, you're not thinking about other things. You're not concerned about convenience or how things will appear. You want that fire out. And so if you are that student asking that question, and your teacher said, your question is splendid, and that's their answer, what are you left with? Where do you go now? Where do you turn in your mind? That's the way to enter into the question. You know, a student goes into Dokusan, meets face to face, they ask a question. They may leave feeling that the teacher heard them or not, responded to their question or not, but what do they leave with? That's the function of Dokusan. Now, what do you do with that? Your question is splendid indeed. That's right. And then we talk about the great doubt. And doubt, in our time, we have to always qualify. Doesn't mean self-doubt. Because that's where everybody goes. Oh, I know a great doubt. I feel insecure. I doubt myself. I criticize myself all the time. That's not what we're talking about. That certainly exists. In fact, it may be one of our modern epidemics. Self-doubt. Engineered, I think, by the various systems and cultural instruments that we live in the midst of, engineered to create an insecurity, because you make people very vulnerable in that. They want to satisfy something. But this great doubt is doubting samsara, is doubting the script, the plan, right, that's been given to us, that we sort of grew up in, that if you do this, you get this, it's all going to be good. Well, it's not. There is much good, but at a fundamental level, something's not. That's the great doubt. In part of the function of training and koans is to raise that doubt. Why at the end of the sitting? You're going to bed. For goodness sake, why don't we sing you a lullaby? All right, sweet dreams. Instead, the liturgy just shoots an arrow right into your heart. Oh, by the way, life and death are of supreme importance. Time is swiftly passing by. To raise that doubt, so to raise that doubt from our inclination to go to sleep, our inclination to become numb, our inclination to accept what we shouldn't accept, to become adapted and accustomed to what we should not become accustomed to. And so spiritual practice, in a sense, is inherently disruptive. It's creating a revolution. And in our culture of engineered convenience, I think that's what the history books will say, if there are any history books, was, you know, these guys just died, you know, under the banner of convenience. Your question is splendid indeed. But the monk persists, but the Buddha practiced on the Bodhisattva, on the seat of enlightenment. Why didn't they attain Buddhahood? Why didn't they attain ultimate enlightenment? And Seijo says, because they did not attain Buddhahood. Because they are a non-attained Buddha. And so here we see that this is not trying to appeal to your intellect and your powers of reasoning. There's something else going on. That's why the instruction of listening to a Teisho is to listen with your heart. To listen to a teaching is to listen with your whole being. It's enlightened mind speaking to enlightened mind. If we do attain it, if we do attain enlightenment, then at some point we'll lose it. If we don't attain it, then the clouds continue to cover the moon. We continue to be lost in confusion. And live with that sense that there is something that is obstructing, there's something that is keeping us distant. And so when Dogen says, and yet, if there's the slightest hair's breadth distance, and so as I said, that is the place where we practice, that gap, that sense of gap, that's where we bring our attention. Because that from that gap arises our melancholy, our sorrow, our sense of isolation, our anger. And so we stop and enter directly into that gap, which is generally the last place we want to go. Right? So popular culture is just all about, let's fill up that gap with a whole bunch of stuff. That's why in the poem, woman says, rather than give the body relief, give relief to the mind. When the mind is at peace, the body is no longer distressed. And mind here is not just your thoughts, your thinking mind, your conceiving mind. It's your whole being. And the Buddha said that in our grasping, that we overestimate the power of things, of pleasurable things, of satisfying things, of meaningful things, to give us an ultimate sense of contentment. They do give us some. That's why it's so difficult, because they work to a certain degree. But that deeper sense is left untouched. And so we overestimate. We have unrealistic expectations, which is why we keep being disappointed, which is why the cycle of keep continuing to look for the next one, the bigger one, the better one. It's not about denying that something happens when we come into contact with pleasure and pain, but that when we seek that as the pathway by which we're going to free ourselves, it's the Buddha said, you will not be successful. He was pretty unequivocal. No one has ever been. Why did this Buddha not attain Buddhahood? Because they did not attain Buddhahood. They were a non-attaining Buddha. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. And it's really important to understand, this is not a play on words, right? The Dharma is not trying to mess with you. I mean, it's trying to get us to stop messing with ourselves. What does all of this have to do with ordinary practice and ordinary practitioners? Everything. How do you allow yourself to feel, allow yourself to feel your inner discontent? That deep, quiet, or maybe not so quiet, the heat of that, the dis-ease of that, and not turn away. But also not to get entangled in a kind of self-defeating narrative about that. How do we hold that, as Master Dawei said, on the tip of your nose, so you don't forget, and yet still allow yourself to experience the joy and the beauty of this life? How do we aspire to not going to sleep and deal with all of the different opportunities we have to do that? To be distracted, to become numb, to become indifferent, and not use that aspiration to awaken, to turn against anything. How do we have aspiration? How do you have aspiration to sit down for a period of zazen and to, with an undivided mind, realize your Buddha nature, because it's your nature, because it's your birthright, and not grasp at that desire? If you don't have the desire, you will not be inclined to practice. It's pretty simple. The stronger that desire, the stronger the desire to practice. The stronger that desire, the greater the inclination to cling to it. Because that's what we've learned to do. So how do you hold that? As I spoke about it in a recent talk, every practitioner has to work this out. You have to work that out within yourself. And it's not a straight line, which means we will cling. We will get frustrated. We will make ourselves miserable. In the process, we'll probably make other people miserable. But if we understand that that is not the way, that's not what we're creating is suffering. That's not bringing us closer. Then it will shift. I was reading with the Daojin yesterday some passages. We've been looking at the Rule of St. Benedict with commentaries by Joan Chittister, who was here many, many years ago. And there's a passage on humility, and she's commenting on a passage of St. Benedict's, on the Rule of St. Benedict, on humility. And she says, to bear difficulties, to face adversity well, is for Benedict a mark of humility, a mark of Christian maturity. It is a dour and difficult notion for the modern Christian to accept. The goal of the 20th century is to cure every disease, order all inefficiency, topple every obstacle, end all stress, prescribe immediate panaceas. We wait for nothing, we put up with little, abide less, and react with fury at irritations. We are a people without patience. We do not tolerate process. We cannot stomach delay. Persist, persevere, patience, Benedict says. It is good for the soul to temper it. God does not come on hoofbeats of mercury through streets of gold. God is in the dregs of our lives. That's why it takes humility to find God where God is not expected to be. She's really speaking about the spiritual path. We do not expect to find wisdom and compassion, Buddha nature, concentration, freedom in oh so many places. And the power of the Mahayana teaching is that it is nowhere else. As Dogen says, it is never apart from this. And that is difficult to have faith in. And so it just takes a little bit of time. We can sit on the Bodhi seat to deny, to try and escape, to avoid, you know, basically means to carry on as before. Whatever before has been, whatever our strategies have been when we begin sitting, why would they not continue? What makes us think that we're suddenly, miraculously, going to stop relying on those same strategies as we engage in meditation practice? Of course they're going to continue. Those are the things we've developed. Those are the things we have trust in. And the more we cling to those, the more heartbreak we experience. Now we just call it Buddhist practice. And so ultimately, the, you know, as I've said before, it's like practice and training is to hold each of us as we enter with all of everything intact, right? All of our karmic, samsaric bane, right? Which it also includes a lot of good, by the way. To hold all of that in each of us, and now collectively, because we're a bunch of us, and to hold and guide each of us and all of us together, and in a sense contain the damage, right? As we continue to be ourselves, as we continue to do what we do. And now, and it spills out onto each other. And to hold that. And so monastic codes were born, and precepts, and guidelines of training, ways of being together, to guide us and support us in that, but also then to sort of hold us individually and collectively accountable to each other and ourselves, so that as we're working it out, we stay healthy. There's a koan that asks, on a path of 99 curves, how do you go straight? That's what training is. How do you go straight on a path of 99 curves? The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? And so we practice. We engage. We turn towards all of those time-tested and multitudes of people tested practices and teachings to realize that essential truth. The way is all-pervading and perfect, complete. So every insecurity, every sense of doubt, every sense of inherent flaw, of inherent anything, is to be liberated. You know, we think of practice as liberating ourselves. In a sense, it's we're liberating our thoughts. We're liberating our emotions. We're liberating each other. We're liberating objects from the constraints of our mind that our mind has put everything into and that we then impose. And so the Examining Whiteness meeting we're going to have in afternoon, which we are now doing every month, it's just that. You know, the text that we're studying, White Fragility, Robin DiAngelo lays that out in the very first words, in the very first sentences. In all of her training and doing anti-racist work, why is it in this country that whenever she's talking to white people about racism, that the reactions are so consistently consistent? Denial, defensiveness, anger, retaliation. And she wondered at the beginning, as she was doing this as a career, she thought, oh, people would just be delighted to learn something, to know something new. But that was not her experience. And as practitioners, whenever we see that reaction within ourselves or in others, that is the self arising to defend, to protect what? What? And that's why it is our Dharma practice, is whatever way, particularly those karmic threads that hold so much power, those are the paths we must explore. Because that's because that makes sense. It makes sense why I have seen myself react that way. And because of practice, it also makes sense that I have seen that change. And I've seen the same to be true of others. It's no special skill. It's nothing particularly different. There's nothing different. It's just recognizing those universal truths in which the ways in which we get caught, and the universal truths in which we find our liberation. And so Wu Men says, an ordinary person, when they know it, they become a sage. They become an enlightened being. When an enlightened being, because remember, Daichu Shisho was already enlightened. But there was something that they had not yet attained. What had they not attained? Attainment. And so when an enlightened being doesn't attain it, they become an ordinary person. And that is, in a sense, the full fruition of our path. That's why in the poem he says, once the mind and body are set free, what need is there for a holy person to become a Lord, for an ordinary person to become an enlightened being, for an enlightened being to become anything? One of our students teaches in the city and wanted to introduce meditation to her, I think, grade school students, middle school students. And so we worked out an arrangement where we provided the school with meditation cushions. And the student was recently at Sesshin and gave me a bunch of cards, thank you cards from the students, thanking us for these cushions. And this one I wanted to share because it was so apt. She wrote it to the Sangha and said, thank you so much for the cushions. My name is Danielle and my parents are from Ghana. This meditation has been easy and hard at the same time. Love, Danielle. I thought, yep, you pretty much summed it up. How can something that be so difficult be so true? I remember in my own practice, on my own for 10 years before I got here, sitting really alone, kind of isolated, and so many times feeling like this is so difficult. Do I even know what I'm doing? Is this actually, is anything happening here? All of these questions and doubt, and at the same time, it felt so inarguably true in ways that I could not explain, that I didn't understand. But fortunately, I trusted enough to keep listening. In the commentary, there's a poem that says it nicely. I'll end with this. Let us admire the moon and cherish the flowers. Thus we should live our lives. Never tried to become Buddhas and ruin this precious life.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.